Anaconda is a popular platform for data science, machine learning, and AI. It provides trusted repositories of Python and R packages and has over 35 million users worldwide. Rob Fertrick is the CTO at Anaconda, and he joins the show to talk about the platform, the concept of an OS for AI, and more. This episode is hosted by Lee Acheson. Lee Acheson is a software architect, author, and thought leader on cloud computing and application modernization. His best-selling book, Architecting for Scale, is an essential resource for technical teams looking to maintain high availability and manage risk in their cloud environments. Lee is the host of his podcast, Modern Digital Business, produced for people looking to build and grow their digital business. Listen at mdb.fm. Follow Lee at softwarearchitectureinsights.com and see all his content at leeacheson.com.
Rob, welcome to Software Engineering Daily.
Thank you, Lee. It is very exciting to be here. I actually have listened to this podcast in the past, and so it was a little bit of extra excitement in addition to looking forward to a great conversation.
So why don't you start out by just telling me, you know, what is Anaconda? I'm sure most people on our podcast have at least heard of it, but I'm sure there's probably many people who haven't yet. So let's start out with setting the ground straight and telling everyone exactly what Anaconda is.
Oh man, there's quite a few different answers to that question, I guess. At its core, you know, Anaconda is a company that is really focused on helping people innovate and doing that by giving them a way of connecting to the broader open source ecosystem, specifically around Python, but not just Python. And Anaconda was originally named Continuum Analytics, I think, you know, when it was founded. And they did a lot of work in the data science space, recognized the need to really empower Python programmers, specifically in data science and other areas. And in order to do that, you know, basically they were solving their own problems. These were Python developers that were actually trying to help enterprises run their numerical computing workloads, run other kind of workloads. And they realized, especially in like Windows environments and other environments, that there was a need to standardize how people got access to all the broader open source ecosystem, the Python packages that millions of people around the world were producing. And so they created this distribution of Python packages and Python libraries. Not all of them written in Python, by the way. That's kind of the reason why a lot of this stuff's written in Fortran, C++, and other languages. And getting that on, you know, getting the right bits onto people's computers, helping them do that simply, manageably, et cetera. They came up with the Anaconda distribution, which is, you know, where actually the name came from. You know, you want a big distribution of Python. Oh, big Python, Anaconda. And then suddenly everybody knows Continuum Analytics through the Anaconda distribution. So that's how the name got changed to Anaconda. And so at its heart, we produce trusted repositories of Python and R packages, actually. We provide products and services around security and governance of those packages. And again, that connection to the broader open source ecosystem. And we actually have kind of enterprise products, as you'd imagine, around AI, data science, et cetera. That's our Workbench product and others. And we also do a tremendous amount around the open source ecosystem. So we either actively participate in or fund or develop many different open source projects, everything from Numba to Beware to Panel to, you know, on and on and on. And we donate quite a bit of money to various open source projects as well. But again, the real goal of the company is to connect scientists, data scientists, engineers, programmers, knowledge workers, actually. We can talk about that later, but Excel from Microsoft last year announced that you are now going to actually use the Python programming language inside of Excel.
That's really exciting to hear.
I
remember hearing that. Yeah.
When you have the broader knowledge workers, the kind of advanced knowledge workers that want to have access, again, not just to the Python programming language, but really to that broader ecosystem and all the innovations that those packages and that community provides. And Anaconda wants to connect people to that.
Yeah, I know that one of the problems that lots of languages have, I'm more familiar with the problem of how packages work in Ruby and Rails, especially when there are third-party packages that are not all in Ruby. And so, and how it has to build in the background. And the installation of some of those packages can be quite problemsome. Python, it's a lot easier in general, but a lot of that is because of the Anaconda packaging system. Is that correct? Is that the best way to think of it?
I think so, yeah. And actually, there are open source efforts that Anaconda created, Conda specifically, that's where the majority of the user base uses, actually. And I think it's funny, at our last measurement, it was actually 45 million users, which I think a lot of that comes from the explosion in AI and Python kind of being the lingua franca of AI, and using Conda to set up your Python environment and not just get the right bits on your computer in terms of the, you know, is this NumPy, is this SciPy, is this scikit-learn, is this Keras or PyTorch, but getting all the dependencies, all the things those things rely on, and doing that solving in order to make sure that those environments run. Yeah, that's exactly the problem you're talking about.
So quickly deploy small-scale apps to share. I think I got that phrasing from your website, and that sounds a little bit like what you're describing, but it is a lot more than that. But I know one of the major use cases for your platform, and you just mentioned it briefly here now, is the growing field of artificial intelligence and AI tooling and data science in particular. You've kind of taken that a step further, and you're actually pushing a concept that you call OS for AI. Can you talk a little bit about that? You meaning Anaconda, I'm sorry. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I guess it's more of a conceptual or philosophical point than like a literal operating system. And that does confuse some people. But the idea here is you have this, you know, an operating system, you know, kind of takes all the hardware bits, you know, especially, you know, you go back to the 70s when people assembled their own computers, you know, up until this day, but you had to back then. And you needed the operating system in order to take all of that complexity and actually make this platform that then people could then use. People could develop applications for it. People could actually use the hardware and kind of enable that interchange. And conceptually speaking, that's what we feel we do by providing that, you know, providing that middle layer there that connects people to that broader open source ecosystem, makes it simple and easy to develop your applications, to deploy their applications and share them. Sorry, by applications, I mean everything from, you know, traditional data science to modern AI integrated models and applications.
So, but that's not specific to AI though, but are there specific things that you do towards the AI use case that make it better
yes,
for AI?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So it's all an extension of what we did. So if you look at Anaconda and say, hey, I get my Python packages from you, I get my R packages, and you provide ways of doing this, you know, the individual user, that's what they care about. I want to get my environment set up, I want to get access to what I need so I can train a model, I can deploy a model, I can leverage that model inside of my application. Then you have the organizations that employ these people that want to make sure that they have some control over the Wild West that all their users are integrated with. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands, if not more, different packages that could be used. And it's not a very secure world. And so traditionally that was the data science space. And now if you just think, okay, well, if Anaconda is really good at getting bits onto your computer, the right bits for you simply, securely, auditably, et cetera, but we change the definition of those bits. It's no longer a Python and R package. Now maybe it's data sets that you want to use in order to train your models or fine tune your models, or it's the models themselves that you need to get installed and get up and running very easily again for your specific environment. Are you running some kind of a Linux server? Are you running a Windows desktop? You know, what kind of GPU do you have? Do you even have a GPU? Is it a phone, mobile device, edge computing? And so if you kind of broaden what Anaconda does to say it's not just Python and R packages, it's getting the right bits. Those bits happen to be models. They happen to be data sets, et cetera. Then you can see why the kind of AI explosion is a natural extension of what Anaconda does.
So you're also the data delivery for use by AI?
I would say some of this stuff is today, some of this stuff will be.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, so it's a lot of the rapidly changing improvements in the industry right now, which I'll be honest, I think everybody could relate to what I'm about to say, which is I can't even keep on top of it at all. It's that fast. We have the millions of users. We have people who understand how we already help them get their environments up and develop their applications and share them and whatnot. And so that's a very natural extension for them to come to us and say, well, help us with these problems too, and for us to do them. So yeah, some of this is stuff that we do today. Some of this is stuff we'll do in the near future. And some of the stuff is going to be coming.
So some of those data sets though are giant. So are you still packaging those for delivery, or are you also looking at tooling to get access to data sets in other locations and make, yeah, there's a whole world of possibilities there and a whole world of
things there is
involved in it.
And it's not just access to the data itself. It's everything around the actual provenance of the data too. So you have the ongoing copyright discussions and kind of, do I have access to the right data? Do I even know that I'm using the kind of data to train that I have the license to train on, or that I have the right to train on? And so helping people solve those problems, it is a, you know, it's not just us. It's a very common refrain that people are holding off on some of these technologies because they don't understand the exposure. They don't understand what they can do and how they can do it. And then you'll even hear things about like, what data should they even be training on? What data should they be using? And so I went and attended a very interesting presentation on the Phi model from Microsoft at GTC. And they were making the point that, you know, sometimes training these models is a bit of garbage in, garbage out. You know, you want to use high quality data. And so it's one thing to train your data in all your models, I'm sorry, on all the data on the internet. It's another thing to say, we're going to actually take a subset of that data and get better output because we've, you know, we don't need to have every possible piece of fan fiction that was ever written incorporated into our model when we really want it to be an expert in, you know, I don't know, science or physics or something else. It's not just about the sizes of the data sets. It's about provenance. It's about security. It's about auditability, reproducibility, and then collaboration and sharing.
Cool. So two different topics, and I'm just taking from words that you said, two words that you said, and I'd like to talk about them independently. We could probably have a whole conversation on both of them. But one of them is secure, and the other one was copyright. So let's take whichever one you want to cover first, but I'd like to talk about both those areas of what you do.
I mean, flip a coin. They're both tremendously interesting.
Then let's start with security.
All right.
So you mentioned securely deliver to the desktop, the package, whatever, whether the package is data code, whatever. So that implies a lot of things and perhaps a lot more than what you actually do. I'm not exactly sure. It could be a wide spectrum of different things that securely delivered to your desktop can mean. Why don't you tell me what you mean by that?
Yeah, again, it could absolutely be a lot of things. But I guess at its heart, it's, you know, they talk about a lot about software bill of materials. You want to think of it as like chain of custody, like you watch, you know, Law and Order, any of the kind of police procedurals. And, you know, you want to make sure that, you know, that evidence, you understand what happened to it every step of the way so that there's nothing that was corrupted. There was nothing, no kind of broken trust or misuse. You can think of packages and whatnot, the same thing. So how do I know that this open source code that I'm pulling into my own, you know, my own computer and I'm trying to use or I'm trying to share with others doesn't have anything nefarious in it? It wasn't the wrong code. It wasn't something that somebody, you know, some malicious actor injected something bad into it. You know, there've been plenty of very high profile security incidents over the years where maybe a company like, well, I don't name any names, but you can look them up, but lots of big name companies had a supplier that provided them software, provided them something, and the attack actually came through the supplier to that major company. And so didn't talk much about my background, but I spent 17 years in high performance computing space. So I've started several companies over the years. And the last one that I founded was acquired by Microsoft in 2017. And so I joined Azure and I led their HPC and AI software infrastructure team from the product side, actually, as opposed to the dev side. And then that's where I left and then joined Anaconda. And so, you know, while at Microsoft, it was a very, very, very major concern that anything we're pulling in from anywhere else, that we understood exactly what we were doing because Microsoft was such a huge target for various obvious reasons. And our clients were such huge targets. And the last thing we wanted is for people to be able to kind of backdoor into our clients through us, through our suppliers and so on. All of those same concepts apply to getting bits onto your computer. And so when it's Python packages, whether it's a model that comes from somewhere, whether it's a data set that's used them, you want that same chain of custody knowledge. You want that same provenance, you want that same control. That could be for security reasons, like I said, in terms of malicious actors, but it could also even just be for reproducibility later. You know, if you're going to use this stuff in pharmaceutical industries or financial industries or other industries that have regulatory needs or other kinds of, you know, especially life or death situations, you know, if your model makes certain decisions, if your system causes certain things and something goes wrong, they're going to want to understand why, and you better be able to reproduce your results. So even just being able to track your data, track your models, track your packages, and control them over time is very important.
This episode of Software Engineering Daily is brought to you by HookDeck. Building event-driven applications just got significantly easier with HookDeck, your go-to event gateway for managing webhooks and asynchronous messaging between first and third-party APIs and services. With HookDeck, you can receive, transform, and filter webhooks from third-party services and throttle the delivery to your own infrastructure. You can securely send webhooks, triggered from your own platform, to your customers' endpoints. Ingest events at scale from IoT devices or SDKs and use HookDeck as your asynchronous API infrastructure. No matter your use case, HookDeck is built to support your full software development lifecycle. Use the HookDeck CLI to receive events on your local host. Automate dev, staging, and prod environment creation using the HookDeck API or Terraform provider. And gain full visibility of all events using the HookDeck logging and metrics in the HookDeck dashboard. Start building reliable and scalable event-driven applications today. Visit hookdeck.com/sedaily and sign up to get a 3-month trial of the HookDeck team plan for free.
So kind of putting a fence on what it is that you do and what it is that you don't do. What you do is you do things like security validation, make sure the chain of custody of the bits is correct and validated so that people can have a surety that the code coming in is where you intended it to be. But what you're not doing is things like packaging the code into separate containers and running them in virtual environments and that sort of thing. You're not managing that process.
Not necessarily. Yeah, that tends to be more what our users want to do, how they want to deploy this stuff. You can think of it as, you know, we do things like CVE curation in some of our paid for products. So we can give people the ability to say, look, these packages or these other bits, they have known vulnerabilities, but we're okay with those vulnerabilities. Those are things we can mitigate, or they don't apply to us, or, you know, we understand them. And so go ahead and use those. But these other CVEs, these other problems, do not use those. And this gets back to giving organizations the ability to just have a bit of control over the Wild West. And so they want to empower their users, they want to empower their scientists and engineers, but they have to have some level of control over that. And so, yes, it's everything from building the source, it's, you know, building it ourselves so that we know that what you're getting is what we have, you know, we've actually produced the artifacts from the source code itself, to CVE curation, to making sure that our stuff integrates with other security providers' tools. As a general philosophy, I very much like to force myself to not think competitively and not think in a zero-sum way. And so anytime there's a sense of like, oh, well, this other person has this thing that we'd like to use too, it's great. How can we work together to give you a better experience, a better solution? And so when it comes to things like security and other capabilities, I don't view what Anaconda does as having to, I don't view people who partner with Anaconda or who are used alongside Anaconda as threats. Instead, it's kind of growing the pie for everyone. So we do look and say, we don't need to do every possible thing for security. We just need to make sure that the pieces that we handle very, very well. And then we integrate with other tooling so that people can, you know, people can get the solution that they need.
Great, great.
This episode of Software Engineering Daily is brought to you by Vantage. Do you know what your cloud bill will be for this month? For many companies, cloud costs are the number two line item in their budget and the number one fastest growing category of spend. Vantage helps you get a handle on your cloud bills with self-serve reports and dashboards built for engineers, finance, and operations teams. With Vantage, you can put costs in the hands of the service owners and managers who generate them, giving them budgets, alerts, anomaly detection, and granular visibility into every dollar. With native billing integrations with dozens of cloud services, including AWS, Azure, GCP, Datadog, Snowflake, and Kubernetes, Vantage is the one FinOps platform to monitor and reduce all your cloud bills. To get started, head to vantage.sh, connect your accounts, and get a free savings estimate as part of a 14-day free trial.
Well, let's go to that second word then. And I'm beginning to think maybe they're more closely related than I initially thought, but copyright. You imply that you do things to help with copyright validation. I imagine there you're talking about the same sorts of things as far as tracking where source of information and things like that, and making sure that it comes from the original source and is credited back to the original source. But can you elaborate a little bit more on what you meant by copyright?
Yeah. So we don't today... You know, if you go get Anaconda stuff today, that's not something we're doing. It's more something we're very, very interested in leaning into. And I feel comfortable saying that we're not going to solve that problem, but we want to be part of the solution to that problem. It's really the same thing. If we want to help people innovate, if we want to connect them to open source and help them do it, you know, simply and securely and stuff, then we have to help with that problem as well. And so we actually recently, Peter Wang, who was the original co-founder of Anaconda and the CTO for a long time. Again, big shoes for me.
Yeah.
And now he was CEO. He recently actually stepped over into the role of chief AI officer. And his, you know, the copyright and kind of data provenance and making sure that we're all doing the right thing with how we use intellectual property and data in terms of training these models and whatnot, that is kind of a passionate subject for him. It was actually one of the reasons I even came to Anaconda, was listening to him talk about those with such intensity and kind of deep thoughtfulness. And so he is also leading some kind of AI specific technology and other developments within Anaconda. And so a lot of this is just around being aware of that problem space and leaning in. Everything from us joining the AI, Anaconda joining the kind of recently formed AI consortium, to even collaborating with people in the legal industry and others to, again, be aware of this problem and help it evolve in a direction that we think is going to be best for innovation. I don't think it's right to look at this and say, you know, lock it down because we don't know how to handle it. At the same point, you know, we have to do this responsibly so that we can keep this kind of commons around for everybody to benefit from.
As a listener of Software Engineering Daily, you understand the impact of generative AI. On the podcast, we've covered many exciting aspects of Gen AI technologies, as well as the new vulnerabilities and risks they bring. HackerOne's AI Red Teaming addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses launching new AI deployments. Their approach involves stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. Within the HackerOne community, over 750 active hackers specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and safety testing. In a single recent engagement, a team of 18 HackerOne hackers quickly identified 26 valid findings within the initial 24 hours and accumulated over 100 valid findings in the two-week engagement. HackerOne offers strategic flexibility, rapid deployment, and a hybrid talent strategy. Learn more at hackerone.com/AI. That's HackerOne.com/AI.
So it is safe to say that you are, as a company, skewing towards AI versus the general package delivery process. Is that a fair statement? Okay.
We're not skewing in the sense that we are moving away. So our existing business, our existing community, our existing efforts and user base, like that is not being abandoned in any way, shape, or form. A lot of this is, as I mentioned, a kind of a natural extension of what our users have been asking us to help them solve, or in many cases, what we've been helping them solve. So, you know, I know you know this, I know a lot of the listeners are going to know this, but AI reminds me of those bands that have been toiling for 10 or 15 years, and then they get a hit album and people are like, whoa, this, where'd this overnight success come from? And it's like, this has been going on for a long time.
Long time, yeah.
And, you know, we've been doing machine learning and artificial intelligence almost from the beginning of the company. It's just the new kind of impact that LLMs have had and some of the advances they've enabled in conversational programming and chat interfaces and that kind of revolution. I think it's broadened what people can apply it to. It's broadened the number of scenarios people can actually, the problems people can solve with the stuff. And so it feels a bit like an overnight shift. And it is in the sense of those breakthroughs, but it's not like the field of AI hasn't existed for decades. In 1997, I worked as a summer intern for a company called Biocomp Systems in Seattle that used neural nets to help people do industrial optimization. People used it for like financial stuff, which the CEO was really unhappy with. And I remember leaving that job and thinking, oh, neural nets are so cool. I'll never see those again. obviously very wrong about that. But anyway, so this stuff's been around for a while and Anaconda has been working on it and helping people with these problems for a very long time. And so it's really just, I think, the explosion of interest, the kind of addressable market, if you will, the number of problems makes it seem like we're, I guess, you know, moving over there. And I think instead it's really more adding these capabilities and bringing them to our community and then adding all that energy and kind of growing it for everyone.
I got a story to go along with your early AI story. In 89, I was working for Hewlett Packard and my boss at the time, along with his boss and a couple other people from the group I was working at, had moved not long ago from working on a Lisp machine, which was part of the HP AI strategy. And that was, it was all Lisp. Lisp was the AI language of choice. That was back in the 80s. And it wasn't long where you didn't hear about that anymore. And it's like, well, AI obviously isn't going to happen. This is just, no, it's never going to come. This is unrelated to anything that has any value anytime in the future. And then bam, it hasn't been a bam. It's just been worked on little by little in the background. And now suddenly it's come into its stride. And, yeah. And it's really has made some great progress in recent years.
A good friend of mine, a gentleman named Ian Finder, he actually has a Lisp machine.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Ian collects computers and has a mind-blowing collection of technology that he has. I've worked with him for years previously and yeah, a good friend. But yeah, the Lisp world is definitely a world I'm familiar with. And one thing I try to keep in mind with anything is things are never quite as good as they seem, but they're never as bad as they seem either. And with hype cycles, it's the same thing. And so, you know, AI is going to take over the world. You know, sure, super worried about, you know, the impending doom or the impending transformation. No, I don't think it's going to be as good or as bad. But I think you're right. People get caught up in those cycles like they did in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And the disappointment that it isn't as good as they thought it was going to be leads to that disillusionment. When in reality, it's just a long, steady march towards progress.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. And AI is going to be a major part of that, just like other technology has been, but no more, no less than that. Eventually, we just don't know exactly where yet. And so I was speaking to a group of interns the other day and their number one question was, will we have jobs anymore? Software interns. I said, well, a couple of things to keep in mind. One, AI is going to change jobs, but it's not going to eliminate jobs. It's going to change jobs. And just like any other piece of technology, it's going to change jobs. But the other thing is, if any job is going to be even more important than it was before when in the world of AI, it's software developers. So don't worry. And that actually helped a lot, I think. But I think it's amazing how many people are actually worried about AI at this point. And not really for valid reasons. Well, they're valid reasons, of course, but they're not reasons that are going to come to fruition. We just don't know yet. It's just too early to tell for sure what's going to happen. But history has shown us what will likely happen.
I think it's that uncertainty that is what drives the worry. If you have a high trust environment, you know, if you can rely on your community, your friends, your coworkers, you know, whatever group you're kind of thinking about, and you have that support and you have that trust, I think you can face that uncertainty and that adversity together. When it removes some of the worry. I think when you have a low trust environment, then you feel much more responsible for yourself to solve those problems. And I think it leads to that anxiety of, what if I do lose my job? How am I going to pay my mortgage and feed my family? But I do try to maintain a positive attitude that, you know, technology, industrial, societal progress has made the world better for everyone. I would not trade my life today to go back and be a Roman emperor. I would absolutely not. And, you know, and so as a result, again, I try to keep in mind that, yes, there's going to be change, but we're going to navigate it together. And my own purpose, you know, my own kind of goal in life is to make the world a better place and hopefully capture a bit of that betterment for me too. I am a capitalist, but I do want to make the world a better place. And that means helping, not to be too grandiose, but helping the world through this change, like trying to make it so that as we go through this AI revolution, it is better for everyone. But to your point, yeah, I absolutely think there's going to be jobs in the future. And I think one thing that I made the mistake early on, I took a lot of pride in being like a hardcore C++ developer and being like, you know, really low level knowledge and all this kind of hard stuff. And I actually shied away from Python for a long time because to me, it was like, if the tool wasn't hard, was it a real tool? And I had kind of lost the purpose, which is to solve a problem. Like, why are you doing what you're doing? And all of a sudden it was like, hey, we're actually trying to solve these other problems. I just want the best tool for the job. And so, hey, if AI is going to remove grunt work, if it's going to be this network of experts that I can have helping me solve problems and answer questions and broaden my creativity and learn things, like, how is that not better for me? And so, yeah, I think as long as you view what you're doing as helping people solve problems, address challenges, do things like that, and you don't get caught up in the specific skill set of the tool or your knowledge, you know, kind of esoteric knowledge of something as being the reason why you have value, then you'll be able to adapt. You'll be able to learn, you know, whatever the latest tool is, learn it, help people keep solving problems.
Yeah. Sounds like we have a similar background. I spent most of my early career in C++ as well. And I was the expert in C++. And matter of fact, I was actually, someone wrote an article about some of the work we were doing at HP in C++ Journal, because we were one of the first ones to use C++ code in a Unix kernel. It was like, that was revolutionary back then. It was like, it's not that hard, you know, because it's just, this is how this works. And of course, it's all pretty common nowadays. But it was kind of interesting. And I always imagined I would never move away from C++. Now, the thing that moved me away from C++ was a project that ended up pulling me into learning Ruby. And I always thought Ruby was such a fake language until I really got to know it. And then now, of all the languages I've used, Ruby is by far my favorite, just because it's so easy to do what you want to do. Now, it's not the best for a lot of environments, a lot of projects that I work on nowadays. But at the time, it was really interesting. But it's the language. It was like your Python that brought me away from C++.
Yeah, I totally agree. And yeah, I remember I took such pride. I did a ton of the template metaprogramming back in the early aughts, and I was so proud. And in fairness, if I not so humbly say, I actually did come up with a great design to a particularly challenging problem that I was working on at the time. But the, you know, I read all Andreescu's books and all that stuff. And it was so much pride in the difficulty of it. And it really was a revelation to say that it's just the right tool for that job, but there are plenty of other tools out there. And yeah, I was introduced to Ruby too. And it was funny. Actually, early on, we had Python versus Lisp arguments, but then we used Chef back when it was still called Opscode, but the Chef automation language. And that was my introduction to Ruby. And it was the same thing of like, oh, again, right tool for the right job, really kind of broadened my perspective.
Yep. Makes perfect sense. Yeah. So when I was doing research for Anaconda, I found a phrase that I found very enlightening that I shouldn't say enlightening, very interesting that I don't think really applies now that we've had this conversation, but I think a better phrase might apply. Setting that context, let me tell you what the phrase was. It was Anaconda is low code AI development. Now, I don't see that in what you're saying here, but maybe a better phraseology for that same comment might be faster on-ramp to AI, get started with AI quicker, easier. Is that a better example of what you really are doing here?
I think those are two aspects. I don't quite think they're the same thing, although they are related. The low code part is, so we acquired a company last year called EduBlox, and it's like a visual programming. It's really, that was originally more around helping people understand and learn Python. It's aimed at students and whatnot. I mean, EduBlox, it's kind of in the names, but the real focus there, or kind of taking the abstraction out of it, is low code, no code kind of composition of capabilities to produce a result. And if you look at things like, I want to have models and I want to incorporate them in my application, like that's just more Lego blocks that you're kind of using to assemble and build your final structure. But yes, faster on-ramp to AI, that is both what we're trying to do today and I guess a guiding principle of the company. And that is everything from making it simple, I don't want to repeat myself, but making it simple for people to incorporate. And you're going to see some stuff coming from us later this year, I think, that'll embody those things much more clearly.
Great. I'm actually very much looking forward to seeing that now. That's great. Talk about standardization. How does standardization fit into your strategy?
In what way? What do you mean?
So is AI closed or open?
I'm obviously biased in this perspective. But you know what? I'll put it this way. I think open source ecosystems have clearly demonstrated over the last couple decades that they really drive innovation. And, you know, look at the change in Microsoft. Look at the Microsoft under Gates and then under Ballmer, definitely under Ballmer, open source was absolutely a feared term there, and all the kind of FUD at the time. And then now, one of the largest, if not the largest contributor to open source projects in the world. And it's really, it's not just in words. It's actually throughout that company's DNA now. And I think being able to say, look, there are billions of people in this world, and we want to empower all those people. You know, talent is evenly distributed. Opportunity is not. So let's make opportunity be equally distributed. And let's give people the ability to contribute all that innovation. I don't see how any closed ecosystem, any one company could possibly hope to compete with that. Obviously, I work at a company. I want companies to be successful. Again, I'm a capitalist. But I think the world's a better place when you have that open innovation. And there is absolutely a role to play there. Anaconda does look at this. We say, okay, what are the kinds of problems the community doesn't want to solve? What are the kinds of problems that communities aren't good at solving? What are the kinds of problems that we can collaborate with those communities? And then what are the kinds of problems those communities run into in organizing and collaborating and maturing and operating over time? And how can we help address those problems? And so when it comes to that, I guess I'm a true believer that open source and open collaboration, that's the main driver. Standardization, I think, really helps when it comes to helping to enable that. You know, if you want to get together with a friend and go to dinner, that's trivial, right? You know, now it's maybe a birthday party and you got 10, 20 people. It takes a little bit more effort. You might have to schedule a time, you might have to make a reservation, you have to put some effort in. Now you're doing a wedding and you got 100 people, you got 200 people, and like that takes real planning. And then now you have like a major concert. You have, you know, you're Taylor Swift and you want to come to a city and take over. And it's just orders of magnitude more collaboration. And I think when you want to have innovation happen at scale, and when you want to enable people to build and to, again, put those Lego blocks together, you have to have some kind of definition of a Lego block, right? If you had 50 different kinds of sizes and connectors and whatnot, like no one's building, you know, whatever the latest hot Lego model is. And so I think there's a role for standardization, which is really all people just coming together and saying, look, let's define the, you know, you're a programmer, so you get it. Like you have an API. Let's define the interfaces and let's define those interfaces so that we are all free to innovate within those interfaces. But now we have those ways of collaborating together. So that's where I believe standardization can play a role. Where I don't like standardization, I think I would go so far as to say, I think you and definitely the listeners would agree to this, is when it's used for any kind of capture, when it's used for any kind of, in the old days, companies were trying to get into standards bodies and make it so that their technology was the only compliant one or things like that. But again, getting back to supporting open source and supporting the commons, I think there are ways of having those standards that foster innovation and foster collaboration without locking people out.
So you can imagine open interfaces for AI. That general comment can apply to a couple different layers within the AI ecosystem. It can, you know, certainly companies like OpenAI are trying to create open interfaces to give you access to AI, but there's also interfaces to consistent uses of the same data sets and making data sets available for AIs and making large language models available for multiple use cases in different ways and standardization that can happen in those areas, or openness, I should say. Maybe it's a better term than standardization, given the language you're using. I'm not sure. We can talk about that. But there's different layers there. Where do you think we are in that hierarchy as far as, you know, we know how to do open software and we know how to do open APIs. Do we know how to do open data sets? Do we know how to do open large language models? Do we know how to do whatever the next level is there? Are we good at that yet? Are we starting out, or do we just not know where we're going yet?
That's an interesting question. I've never been asked that question with that phrasing and framing, which is really cool. I would say, on one hand, I think we absolutely do know what to do. And what I mean by that is, you look at how software has been distributed with, you know, the different licenses and the kind of evolution of how people open up their code and the variety of ways that people can do it. And you say, okay, conceptually, we're probably going to do the exact same thing for data. We're going to do the exact same thing for models. So I think in that sense, there's a bit of, I don't want to say it's common sense. I'm not trying to oversimplify, but I do think that there is a way of saying, look, these problems were solved in this domain. Let's just broaden our perspective and say, okay, they're probably going to be solved in a similar way. The devil is in the details, though. So the part that we haven't gotten right is, what do those data licenses look like? How do we make sure that people who contribute are maybe compensated or credited and whatnot? And so it's not that those technical challenges and those legal challenges and those philosophical challenges aren't there to be solved. But I do think that we can say we've solved these problems before in a different domain, and we can just almost apply those approaches in this new domain. I think there's a tendency to look at something new and say, this is new, and so therefore it's entirely new. You know, we don't know how to do anything in this area, when in reality, it's just a different view of the problem you've already solved. And so you just kind of have to have that adaptation. But it's going to take a while to shake through all that. And given the, again, the massive uncertainty and the kind of changes there, and honestly, the economic impact, it's probably going to be a complicated discussion.
You know, I 100% agree with everything you said there, but there is one aspect with things like data and the large language models that use data that's different typically, not all the time, but typically compared to just code. And I hate saying the word just code, but you know what I'm saying. And that is privacy. And you know, whether we're talking about PII or whatever, there's information in data that is specific and valuable just by having the data. Independent of whether you have the right to use it or not, having that information may or may not be appropriate, and the privacy aspects that go with that.
Yeah.
That's different than with code, though. There's rarely a time where code itself, you know, open source code has to be private.
No, you're absolutely right.
Rarely that situation, but that would be a situation with data. Open source data might still be private.
Yeah, that's exciting. The emergent risks or problems that come also when you know, any one data set may be fine, but you could put three or four of them together and suddenly now you can identify people, and suddenly now you can do attribution. So there is an issue where, you know, you get these emergent things that come out of, okay, well, I've released my data set because it's fine by itself. There's no PII or there's no way of tying it back. But then you get, you know, other people release their data sets and suddenly somebody realizes, well, if I get data sets A, B, C, and D, now I can do horrible things. Well, how do you deal with that problem? Because at the source, each one of those data sets is fine. And so how do you, that's exactly a challenge. And I remember the first time I learned that, you know, this is obviously even before AI, this is just when people were like, oh, I can take, I don't know, IP address information, and I can take, you know, health information, and I can buy data sets from credit card companies and, you know, your Shoppers Club card for your grocery store. And I can put these things all together and I can learn all kinds of interesting stuff about you that you did not intend. But again, every data set provider in that sense wasn't doing anything wrong.
Right, right.
And so how do you then deal with that in this world where models can be trained on that data and then people can actually do stuff is a very interesting question. I don't have an answer for that one. This is why I love being in this space. Every day somebody asks me a question, like, I get excited.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, I think you would agree that this is an important area that has to be dealt with in the open data.
Well, I do. Anyway. I also wonder how much data is actually not going to be public. I think there are a couple of guiding principles that I think I'll just say I have at the moment, always open to evolving them. But one of them is that, you know, small open source models are going to be great, if not perfect, for many, many people, but they're going to want to be able to control the data. Like, I think the AI revolution has really, I think, changed people's view of the data, right? Like, you see people putting all their content behind paywalls or locking it behind agreements that you're not going to use to train models because they suddenly realize, hey, all that data is actually incredibly valuable in a way that it was not that it wasn't before, but that, you know, there wasn't that direct connection. And so I think you're going to have people keep those data sets private, and they're going to want to train their models internally. They're going to want to govern them internally and probably run them privately or at the edge or in some hybrid fashion. And so I think that is a change. I think you're going to see what people previously kind of gave away, or at least it didn't necessarily govern, and they aren't going to do that anymore. And so that will actually hinder innovation. It'll be very interesting to see, like, does that mean that only companies that have massive resources like OpenAI and others and Microsofts and the Googles of the world that can license content are going to be able to train? Or, you know, how is that going to evolve over time? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that's one of the fundamental questions that's going to come with the whole AI revolution. Are we Is AI going to be, in general, giant data sets, or is it going to be many, many, many small data sets and training that comes from that? I think there's a big world in the small data set AI. Let me give you a simple example. I would love more than anything. I write a lot of content. I've got books and articles and everything that I've written. I would love nothing more than to take all my content, put it into an AI, and have a chat bot be on my website to be able to have people ask questions and respond with things that I know. Now, I know I can do this today. I just haven't taken the time to do it. And I know there's companies that are looking or have started to do that sort of thing, but that's really what I want. That's not a large data set problem. It's a large learning problem, but it's not a large data set problem. Should we be separating the learning and the ability to learn from an AI model from data to be able to do things like that easier?
If I'm understanding your question, I think so, because I like to think of these models as almost like a expert assistants. A grad student that maybe is fresh out of college, or or even just a computer science student fresh out of college. If I'm building, I'm a technical co-founder of a startup and I'm trying to build a team out, I don't look for one person that can be the product manager, the technical lead, the system architect, the IT person, security person, the front end developer, back end developer, et cetera. I look for a team of people and I combine them together, and it's the sum is greater than the individual parts. That's the power there. And I feel the same way about AI models. And so I think you're right. Being able to say, we have these, you'll see that through a mixture of experts and other systems that say, let's take these individual pieces and put them together and actually generate that way. As I mentioned earlier, you train your model on the entirety of data on the internet, and you're going to get every piece of fan fiction. You're going to get celebrity birthdays and, celebrity obituaries and you name it, all in that model. Do I need those in order to ask it to help me how to improve the flow of my story or the grammar, or to explain physics concepts to me? Or, I'm a big fan of Khan Academy. If I'm trying to brush up on different math concepts, I don't need all that. And so I think you're exactly right. Taking small data sets and small models and putting them together so I have this team of experts that really enable me and empower me, I do think that that is a large part of the future.
That's great. So I normally about this time in an interview ask, so what's next or what's the future? But we've been talking a lot about that. But maybe the best way for me to rephrase that question this time is to say, we've talked a lot about where AI is going, but where is Anaconda going next?
Perfect. Yeah. So we did touch on this earlier, but it's taking what we've traditionally done, getting the right bits on your computer, making it manageable and governable, and then helping people solve kind of higher level AI, machine learning, data science problems, and expand that into data and models. I mentioned serverless Python, things like PyScript and whatnot that allow you to actually execute this stuff using the cheapest hardware, which is the hardware you already own, i.e. your laptop or your phone, things like that. We're also very, very heavily focused on high performance Python. People often talk about, Python's not as fast as C++ or it's inefficient or whatever. And I think getting back to the earlier point about why, what are you trying to solve? Why is this not the right tool for the job forever? That wasn't the limiting factor. The limiting factor was getting it into people's hands, making it understandable. And again, collaboration, secure, all the stuff that Anaconda traditionally focused on. But Python's the lingua franca of AI, and AI is central to the world. And that NVIDIA GPU isn't cheap. And they're in short supply. And so helping people get the most out of their investment in their infrastructure is actually a core concern. And I think Anaconda is uniquely suited to help solve Python performance problems. And so it's a category of problems and it's a category of technologies and approaches. So you're going to see a lot of stuff from Anaconda around that, both directly from Anaconda, but also what we're going to foster in the open source ecosystem and the Python ecosystem, everything from the interpreter to the language to the libraries, you name it. And then, you kind of combine those all together, and it's really about making it easy for people to build these models, to incorporate these models, to deploy these applications fast, efficiently, effectively at scale.
This has been a great conversation, Rob. I really appreciate it. We're so close to being out of time, but I want to thank you so much for coming on. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you.
My guest today has been Rob Futrick, the CTO, not the EVP of engineering, but the CTO at Anaconda. Rob, thank you for joining me on Software Engineering Daily.
Thank you, Lee. I always love an exciting conversation, and thank you for absolutely providing one. It's been fantastic talking to you.